We have lots of people on the call. Welcome, everybody. This is Paul Cook, and my guest today is Meet Andrews from Florida. It's 7 a.m. in Australia on Tuesday morning, and I think it's 5 p.m. where you are, Meet.
Yes.
And quite late in the night in London and Europe, and those of you who've called in from Europe, congratulations. It's well past your bedtime, but it's great to have you all on the call. I'm very excited to have, this is our largest turnout ever. We had well over 30 registrations for this call of people wanting to participate. And that's very exciting because we started out, as I was saying earlier, with only one, myself and my guest. So to now be over 30 after several months, it means that we're doing something right. And the recordings of these calls are going up onto the directionjournal.com website. From now on, in fact, from today on, all our recordings that we do live are only going into the fully paid subscription section. So up until today, everything that we've done in the past, including Michael Gell, Jeremy Chance, Catherine Kedrick, Josephine Gray, all of these wonderful guests we've had, they are all going to be sitting in the free subscription part of the website. And a lot of people have said to me, why are you giving so much stuff away free? Well, I actually don't like charging for it, to be honest, but the only reason I have to put a fee on things is because it costs money to run the magazine and the website and all that kind of thing. So the majority of the calls, all the calls we've done up until now, the live ones, will be sitting in the free subscription site. Of course, if you have a paid subscription, that gives you access to all of that as well. But anyhow, there's many levels and layers. I won't get started on all my ideas for Direction Journal because that's not the reason we're all here today.
But thank
you. We're all here today.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Yes, to meet.
Thank you.
And have a chat over coffee or tea with Meet Andrews. And Meet and I began a conversation several months ago when I received an email about her group workshops with Alexander Technique teachers. My eyes lit up and my ears pricked up, and I thought, now this is something that I'm sure many Alexander teachers around the world would love to have access to, but just don't have the opportunity to drop into your workshops in North America. So for me, 50 to 70 people showing up to an introductory workshop is fairly normal, which is unheard of for me personally, and I really do want to know how she manages that and then what she does with them once they are there, all these people. A little bit about Meet before we get started. Meet has taught and performed as an actor, dancer, choreographer, director, and movement coach for dance and theatre companies throughout her career. She trained at the Alexander Alliance in 1983, graduating in 86, and most recently completed her teacher refresher course with John Nichols in New York City, and also did a course with Jessica Wolfe in the Art of Breathing. And Jessica, we had on our live call a couple of months ago. Had a great chat with Jessica. Meet has taught throughout US, Canada, Europe, and Japan. Not Australia yet, Meet, but we're going to work on that, can't we?
I have been to Australia.
Oh, you have? Oh, you didn't tell
me
that.
I forgot.
Oh, good. Must have been before my time. And you currently have your own private practice in Boca Raton. Is that how I say that?
That's right.
Okay, I've got the pronunciation. And you teach at the graduate acting program at the Florida Atlantic Uni, travel all over the countryside, and you continue to present workshops at the Studio Theatre in Washington, D.C., where you've been working professionally for 20 years. I've also presented you some of this material that we're going to talk about today at the Lugano Congress last year. So, Meet, welcome, and it's great to have you here.
Thank you. I wanted to thank you, Paul, for setting all of this up and providing us all for this opportunity to join as a community of Alexander teachers. And, you know, I think what moves me so much is how much we all love this work. And we know the deep ability it has to enhance our lives in every respect, and that we share our continuing exploration of this work, and we're always discovering new possibilities. And we each have our own relationship to Alexander's process in relation to our life journey. And that's really what's been true of mine. Because I have been in a group setting for most of my life due to the fact that I started ballet at the age of 8. And then I went to grade school, of course, and that's a group setting. But really in my artistic life, I was always going to classes in a group and rehearsing in a group and performing in a group. And that happened throughout my career. So I guess I could say I'm in a way used to teaching in groups because I've lived that way for a long time. And yet when I began to teach the Alexander work, I had to figure out how to establish a relationship with each group that I teach because every group is different and every activity that they might be exploring, whether they're dancers or actors or people who just want to live more joyously with change in their lives, I have to figure out how to reach them within that group setting. And I think what happened for me that really woke me up was I was teaching in a university setting, and I had 3 classes in a row of about 25 people. And in the first class, I used some of the movement work that I have developed in relation to Alexander's principles, and it went very well. Everyone was very receptive. And then in the second class, I was sort of tired after lunch, and I decided I wouldn't do any of that. I would just start right away working with people. Well, the class fell very flat, and I could not seem to get the energy moving. And so in the third class, I went back to my introductory kind of work, and everything was fine again. So what I've developed, I call preparing the receptive field, because I know that I want to get to the specifics of Alexander's process, and that I will be working with one person in front of the group. But when I begin with some kind of kinesthetic exploration or a movement exploration or a structure that allows them to explore some aspect of Alexander's process, I find that their interest is heightened by that experience, and it also helps them form a group. They form a group with each other so that they feel more comfortable with each other. And then they're kind of giving up their thinking about how they should be with their posture. They start to give that up. And then at the end, they're really ready to follow someone else when I work with them individually and stay with me and stay with the student. So that, in a nutshell, is how I've kind of developed what I do.
And it, like you say, you came from a culture of group classes, so that was natural for you to take it that way, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was natural. But it's not everybody's way, and I think sometimes people don't choose it, but I also think that there's a way to learn how to do it if you want to. And I just finished teaching in May. I was teaching in Toronto a group of teachers, and teachers who were training to be teachers. And I started developing this way of working in front of a group, because often, you know, when you're up there, you have to keep track of yourself as the teacher with your own inhibition and direction. You have to keep track of the student that you're working with, and you have to keep track of the group. And so often what I do is I have the group sit in a circle, so that the energy is focused toward me and the person I'm working with, and they can see each other as well. And that seems to also help them focus as I'm working with someone. And I in my acting work, I have done this work from Stanislavski called Circles of Attention, in which you start by paying attention to yourself, which is the first circle of attention. And that would be what we all do as Alexander teachers. And then the second circle is to include what's close by, which in this case would be the student. That's the second circle of attention. And then the third circle of attention is the joining of the teacher and the student in the work. And then the fourth circle is the group sitting in a circle. So if I, as a teacher, can unify these circles of attention, then people will stay with what we're doing. And it's a juggling act, but it's really exciting.
Well, we've jumped right into how you work, Mead. And,
I know I did. Yeah.
That's fine. I don't mind. That's where all the questions have come from, is how do you do it?
Yes.
So that's fine with me. Why don't we keep going on this topic?
Okay.
We'll come full circle back to maybe some of the bigger picture Alexander Technique things. But when you say you've got these four circles of attention, you bring the attendees of the course from themselves to their peers, to the teacher, and then to the group as a whole.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
How long does that take? Is that like a half an hour process or a 10-minute process?
Well, when I'm working with teachers in this, we could spend a whole session, maybe a 2-3 hour session on this, working with
yep.
it, and then having them practice it. I think it offers a lot of possibility for exploration within it. I think it's a beautifully contained and structured series of circles that overlap, but you could take any one of the circles and explore them. And then what often can happen is one of the teachers who is in the group could get up and explore it in front of us, and then we can give them feedback about how they work with these circles.
All right. So for each level of each circle, then, you have a movement or a kinesthetic example that people can try.
Well, not in that case. That is a particular one that I use primarily with teachers when they want to teach in front of a group. So that's one aspect, I think, of group teaching is how do I stand and be in front of a group and teach the work and sustain the attention of the group. And then the other piece is what kind of movement etudes and explorations can I do with a group that will enliven their kinesthetic awareness, their thinking process, and their curiosity about the Alexander work. How can I give them an experience that will wake them up at all those levels, and then that will allow them to stay with me when I work with someone in front of them? So that's, I think those are two different pieces.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go to the circles first, and then we'll come back to the movement etudes. So the circles of attention that you work with Alexander-trained teachers, can you give me an example of what you may do with them?
Well, one of the things that I start with is a very simple, an acting exercise, where everyone stands in a group, in a circle, and the first person says the word yes. And what we've worked out that they mean by that is yes to stepping back away from my habitual response and opening up myself to directional thinking. So that yes is a moment of expansion through inhibition and direction. Then the next yes they say to someone else in the circle across from them. And when they say that yes to that person, they start walking toward that person. And that person then has to say yes to themselves and yes to someone else and move away so that that person can take their place. So that's a very interesting learning process, because once we get an instruction, we want to do it, you know. So everybody learns a lot about inhibition and direction by doing that particular yes exercise. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, that is something that you do with the teachers. Would you do that within your workshops as well?
Yes, I might, depending on the group that it, you know, that I'm with. Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
The main goal for your workshops with trained teachers is what exactly? What are you looking to achieve?
Well, I think what I'm looking to achieve is their modes in which they can begin to teach this work in a group setting that will be true to the principles of the Alexander Technique and that will allow people in the group to have an experience that will enliven their thinking and their kinesthetic awareness and make them very receptive to the moment when I start to work with one single individual in front of that group.
Uh-huh. So you're looking, okay, so you want them to be fully awake by the time that you do one-on-one work with someone.
Yeah, right. And what I usually do is I do about 15 minutes of this, let's say it's an hour and a half or a two-hour class, group class, and I will do 15 minutes of this kind of preparing the receptive field. And I think everybody is capable of developing these structures that will utilize the principles, assist people to kind of really let go of their need to have good posture or to come from that mode of thinking and explore moving in a way that is not posturally based or not habitually based. And then that would be in relation to a theme like direction, for instance. Direction is a theme for the evening. What is direction? What does that mean? What is directional thinking? What is the sequence of directional thinking? All of those things. Because then that's what we're going to work with Alexander-wise. And they begin to have some idea of what this whole field of direction might be about.
Oh, great. You've just hit on something that I was wondering about before. So you're saying
yes.
That once you're experienced with preparing the receptive field in your own practice or with your own preparation for the,
yes.
the workshop, that you might be able to run through that in 15 minutes for yourself. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I would. That's the amount of time I would use in the beginning of a group class to set up an exploration around the principle of the Alexander work that I might want to deal with that night by, you know, when I work with people individually.
So you're saying that you'd spend about 15 minutes preparing the group or preparing yourself?
The group.
The
so,
group.
For instance,
okay.
If I were going to work with direction one night, or if it was the very beginning of an Alexander workshop that was a series of classes, I might do what I call moving through the joints, which is that I guide them to move through every single joint in the body. And I give them information about the joints, not a lot of information, because we have to keep moving, so that they can begin to understand that we're looking at a whole design that we can't possibly fix in a postural way. But there's always adjustment. There's always change. There's always redirection of energy, and there's always movement through these joints that is in a particular direction. So I'm really setting up, for a lot of people, a whole new way of thinking and moving. And most everybody will do this kind of work with me, you know, whether they are movers or not, because they become very interested in how their body is designed and how movement travels through their body directionally. So that's just one example.
Okay, good. So going back to the kind of movement, and you call them etudes. Now that's
yes.
the dancing term?
Well, I think etudes is also in music. There are music etudes that people practice. It's a little bit, Chopin had a lot of etudes. I think they're taking a certain quality of music or a certain aspect of music and exploring that in a short piece. That's what an etude is.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I like
Isn't
that
nice?
Lovely.
Yeah, I really like that.
So let's say you've got a group together, you have, and I'm going to ask you soon how you get this many people into a group, but let's say there is 50, you've managed to gather 50 brand new people into a room who are coming to Alexander Technique for the very first time. And they are from all walks of life. They don't have to be from a performance background. They're just people that have an interest, have a concern or something that they want to apply the technique to. What kind of a movement etude or group of etudes would you work or develop for these people?
Okay, I want to go back into a little bit of my earlier history, because I teach on residential courses now in which there might be 25 or 30 people in a group, but I don't do those huge groups so much anymore. But I used to do them and when I lived in Washington. And I wanted to share this with people because I'd almost forgotten about it. But in Washington, when I first came to Washington in 1974, there were no Alexander teachers there. Now there are about 35. And I was not an Alexander teacher. I came there to teach at a university. And there was one group of people at the time that were importing an Alexander teacher from New York once a month. So I joined that group. And little by little, people got certified as Alexander teachers over maybe the course of 5 or 10 years when I was there. And what we did was we formed an alliance of teachers in Washington. We called it the Alexander Technique Teachers of Greater Washington. And it still exists. And it was people who had trained in many different ways. And that was tricky because, you know, we all had our different approaches. But we got together, and what we did was, Washington is divided into quadrants. Like, there's four big sections of the city. And then Virginia and Maryland are right, you know, adjacent. So each one of the teachers lived in one of these places. So, for instance, one teacher who was very active in a particular church, it was a Unitarian church, so they were very open to us using their space. She told all of her students and the other groups that she knew in that area, we told ours, and we told them to tell people. And that's where we got the 70 people that came to that Unitarian church. And that particular time, I happened to be the one who introduced the work. And what I did two really simple things. First, I had them close their eyes, and I gave them a stimulus of a thought. I said, this is your thought. I have to do it fast and get it over with. And after a few moments, I then asked people to tell me what happened for them in their bodies, in their thinking, when they gave themselves that thought. So people would talk about how their breathing got shallow and their heart rate increased and they felt anxious. So we did that. And then I gave them another thought. I said, I'm at ease with myself and I have all the time I need. And so they took that thought and saw how it affected them. And then I asked them again, you know, what was their response? And they said they felt that their breathing released and they came to sense something whole about their bodies and all kinds of wonderful things that we all wanted to hear. They said them, so we didn't have to say them. So that was a major thing that I did. And then I did, because it was a big space, I did a very simple walking etude where they simply walked and began to notice, for instance, where they felt heavy in their body, where they felt light, where they felt movement was easeful, and where they felt movement was stopped. And then we talked about it. You know, a few people talked about it. And then from there, because all of the teachers were there, we divided into small groups after that. And each student then had an individual experience. So I feel like that is a really great structure that people could work with, and I wanted to share it. with everybody.
Yeah, I agree. That if I can break that down then into very simple bullets, you started with this is for very large groups, obviously. Very large groups, you've given them a couple of things to think about to give them a contrast on how their thinking affects their physiology.
Yes.
And you found that those very basic thoughts were produced enough of a response even in people that weren't very conscious of themselves.
Yes, it did.
Really? That's amazing.
They could sense those things, such as breathing, how their breathing was affected.
Yeah. Well, that's great. So then that really started the whole workshop off, or the introduction off, with them thinking about themselves rather than, learning something brand new to do.
Right, exactly.
And that's one of the big keys, isn't it? Everybody wants to know, as Alexander said, everybody wants to know what to do.
Yeah.
But in reality, it's all they're doing which is causing the problem. So you're starting off by saying, okay, this is stay where you are and notice what happens when you think this. And then once they've had that little realization, oh, that's interesting, then you go to having them observe, take that level of observation into walking around the room.
Yes.
And then would you bring, and then you've got some responses from the audience, did you then bring anybody up to the front and work with them in front of people?
You know, I can't remember if I did at that particular time, but I have done that, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Just so people can have an understanding of what that experience might look like and might be like. And then they would, after that, then they would go into the smaller groups and have their own experience. And I think a lot of people do this, and each person has their own way of doing this, but I often tell Alexander's story, because I find within it are all the important aspects of coming to your senses and recognizing habitual thought patterns and movement patterns.
And then, of course, you've been able to put this group together with a group of your colleagues. So then when you break them out into smaller groups, then everyone then has an opportunity for a hands-on or a more personal experience, yes?
Yes. And it was really what brought us all together in this Alexander Alliance that we formed in Washington, because after that we began to meet every 2 or 3 months and we worked with each other, and various people presented various topics. And we now have a website in Washington. There's a website for this Alexander Technique Alliance. So it started off, you know, the way it did, and it got bigger and then gradually came to have a website, and we also have a brochure. So that to me seems like a wonderful way to organize an Alexander community in a town and to get, you know, to get a lot of people to come to the workshop.
Looking towards the society or the group that you're paying your annual dues to do it, is to get off out into the world yourself and make a few phone calls.
Right. Yeah.
All right. So you've brought together an alliance of people. They've all put the word out through the local community groups. You brought a great big group into the room. Now, that's what you said, that's what you've been doing, and you did more so in the old days or in the past. Nowadays, you're at Sweetbriar and some of the residentials where there are smaller groups of people. And I'm sure over 20-something years of working, you've refined your thinking and movement attitudes with people even more. So can you give me an example of what you may do with a group which is smaller, so a group of 20 to 25 people?
Do you mean a group of teachers or a group of people who are beginning their study of the Alexander work?
I think on behalf of Alexander Technique teachers, I'd love to know what you do with brand new people from the general public.
Yes. Well, here's something that I was inspired to do, and I think this comes out of my own theater background, is I do something I call the three bodies. And the first thing I do is I we're standing in a circle, and I have them take on Alexander's pattern, his original pattern, and I have them take it on rather gradually because it was a very powerful pattern that he had when he tightened his neck and his head went back and his chest lifted and all those things that he was doing. I have them take that pattern on, and then I have them relinquish it a little bit and take a walk through the space, and then I have them shake hands with someone that they meet. And so they go through this whole three phases. They take on the pattern, they begin to walk with it, and then they shake someone's hand. They interact with them. And, well, that's the first stage. The second stage is that I then have them go to the opposite, which is to move into collapse. And then they walk from there, and they shake hands with someone, and then they come back to the circle. And I ask them each time about what they experienced. And then the third time I do it, I have them juggle imaginary juggling balls. And in the course of that, their primary control is awakened. And they then walk again, and they shake hands again. But they wind up doing many other things in terms of interacting than shaking hands, because they have come out of those two postural extremes. And what happens, first of all, is it gives them an experience of the rigidity of Alexander's pattern and the rigidity of collapse, and then it gives them an experience of how the primary control is the coordination process that's adjusting constantly in every single moment in terms of doing that imaginary juggling. And it unites them as a group also because they're interacting with each other and in a way that's not terribly threatening for them. And in a way, they're kind of taking on a character, and they tend to have fun with it. So that I use that one a lot. I would call that an icebreaker for people in a group who don't know each other at all and for whom I want to give an experience of what is postural habit and what is primary coordination. And that then provides a groundwork for me to begin to start to work with them. So that's an example.
And when you say the juggling exercise gets their primary control going, how do you mean? Is that something that you help them with, or just
need
to juggle?
It just happens, because what's happening is you can't juggle and be in a postural set. It won't work. You can't do that. So their bodies are constantly changing. Their heads are moving because they have to look at the balls. They're changing their balance. They're changing their relationship to gravity. They're using hand-eye coordination. They're doing all kinds of aspects of our primary design. It's being enlivened, but they're not trying to do it because they're focused on the activity of juggling. And by focusing on that activity, it awakens all of that. And then they start to realize, and then I can begin to tell them or give them another experience of what that is. Does that make sense?
That's very interesting. Yes, that is interesting.
Yeah, and I forgot to say one thing that really is sort of the capstone of the whole thing is once they've juggled these imaginary balls, and they can choose their own colors, which is good. They enjoy choosing a color for these imaginary balls. Then I have them juggle those Indian pins, which are like the bowling pins. Then they have to juggle fire torches. So by then, they are completely into it. They are really having a great time with it. And you can see their thinking change when they have to juggle a fire torch.
I bet.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah. And they are they become very enlivened when they go and walk after this experience. And when they go to greet people, their greeting time is very spontaneous, not just shaking hands. So it takes them out of their habitual set pattern of thinking and posture without their even knowing it. I think that's the best way to do it. Alexander's indirect procedures.
Absolutely. You find that from those sorts of activities, the all these sorts of things that you do, that then they naturally want to know more about Alexander Technique.
Yes.
On a personal basis, they just naturally say, I want more of this.
Yeah, they do.
Do you find that they compare it to anything else? Like, oh, this is like so-and-so? Or it's brand new?
Well, I think in that case, it feels something like brand new to them. It's later on that they ask this question, well, is this like yoga? That's a big question that people ask. Because we all want to do this. I remember when I was first learning the Alexander work, and I was a dancer, I decided in my thinking that the Alexander work was about alignment, about having my head in a good alignment with my body, and my body in a good alignment with my legs and my feet. And it was at some moment when I was having a lesson with a wonderful teacher that I suddenly realized that's not the Alexander process. I'm taking the Alexander process and trying to make it something I already think I know. That was a huge moment for me of knowing that the Alexander process is in a class by itself. It is totally unique because to me it is the foundation for every activity and every moment of living. It provides that non-doing foundation for a doing that we call an activity. So I always have thought that Alexander cannot really be compared to anything else. I feel very strongly about it. I think it's a neat, unique approach to becoming your whole self. Mind, body, emotion, everything.
Would that be your personal definition of the Alexander Technique?
For the moment. It's always changing. Because I just think, I feel that maybe what we all love about the Alexander work is that it's not fixed. That I've been studying this work since 1974, and I always learn something new all the time. I always get a new idea about it, or a teacher inspires me. I'm very inspired by a teacher I don't even know right now. Her name is Nadia Kavan.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote an amazing article for the Congress Papers, and she did a workshop in Lugano, but I didn't get to go to it. And I find, you know, just right now, her way of looking at the work is very inspiring to me, and it's changing me. So I think this work is for a lifetime, and that it will always change us and help us to continue to explore. Can I read my favorite quote by Alexander? One of them.
Please.
Okay, it comes from, I don't know, I don't remember where it comes from, but here it is. My experience may one day be recognized as a signpost, directing the explorer to a country hitherto undiscovered and one which offers unlimited opportunity for fruitful research to the patient and observant pioneer.
If only more people in our community looked at his work as a signpost rather than the be-all and end-all.
Yeah, and I love the idea of the patient and observant pioneer. We are still pioneers of this work because it is so full of possibility and life that it can never be finished. There will always be something more. What more could we ask for in life than having found this work for ourselves?
Yeah. Well, on that note, Mead, what I'd love to do is there's 28 or so people on the call at the moment.
Yes.
I know a lot of them would like to ask a question. It's Amanda. Hello, Amanda.
Hi. Can I ask?
Yes, please.
Meet, I just love that quote, and I wanted to know where you found it in Alexander's writing, if he wrote it indeed.
Yes, he did write it. And I have to tell you, Amanda, I have it in my notebook, but I don't have where it came from.
Oh, okay.
I've seen it many times, but I will do my best to find out where it came from.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. It's a good one.
Fran, hi, Fran. Lovely to hear you again. Please ask me the question.
Hi, Deed.
Hi, Fran.
I'd love to ask you, what kind of examples do you use to illustrate inhibition?
Well, I just developed a new one. I have two big ones that I use. It's so hard. I feel like if only I could do this with you. You know what I mean? It's hard to actually talk about some, but I'll do my best. The first one that I like to play with that really frustrates people is that I say that I'm going to call out a number of different activities, and I tell them that they can only lie on the floor. So they're all lying on the floor, and I'm telling them to get up and walk around the room. I'm telling them to go have a seat in a chair. I'm telling them to raise their arm. And I go through a whole list of things I'm telling them to do, and I'm asking them not to do any of them. And then after it's over, we talk about what their experience was. And many times they have this very powerful experience that when they were little, if someone told them what to do, they always did it because it meant they were being a good, you know, a good daughter or a good student, and that when they didn't do it, they felt like they got really tight. So that, you know, and then they have a number of things like that happen. Some of them say how they just had to do it. They just had to get up and do it. And when they couldn't, they got incredibly frustrated. And then some people said how much they enjoyed simply lying on the floor and breathing because they never got the chance to do that. So I use that as a way into the power of inhibition and what it is and how we respond reactively, you know, or how we can allow ourselves to step back. And then I might go to a second round of that and allow them to, when they decide they want to do something, to simply pause a bit before they do it and see what that feels like. Because I don't mention the word inhibition at that moment yet. Does that give you an idea?
Sure.
Of a process?
Do you also use some exercise to illustrate motor sensory amnesia or, you know, the distortion, sensory distortion?
Well, you know what? I haven't ever done that. I've never explored that. One thing I've done about inhibition, again, is I have everybody have a chair, and I have them sit in the chair as many different ways as they can think of, as many different ways as they want to, and then I have them use the chair for anything they want to use it for. They can make it into, you know, a little home that they're sitting inside or all kinds of things. And I go through that, and then I have them just come back and sit in the chair. And suddenly they're really present in the chair without their idea of how they should sit in the chair or, you know, anything that's interfering. And they really are present with that quiet sense of self from inhibition. So that's another one.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should trade notes then. I have
some. Yeah, I'd like to know what you do. That's what I was just thinking.
Yeah.
I think we should all trade notes because these are just my ideas, and there's lots of us.
There is lots of us.
What was that? It sounded like a baby.
That's my baby. I'm sorry. It's Amanda's
baby. Oh, it's wonderful. That's great.
That's cool.
That's a baby talking to us and giving us an idea. Yeah, I just want to say that these are only my ideas that I've developed really out of what I see in groups. you know, and ways in which I try to reach people. That's where they've all come from, is to try to reach them, to create a group, and to bring Alexander's principles to them in a way that will allow them to explore before we get subtle about it. Because often when I get subtle too soon in certain ways, they get a little stiff. So I'm just looking for these ways, and I would always love to have other people's ideas too. I think we can all share them.
Can I ask one more question?
Yes, please, go ahead, Amanda. Just jump in there.
The exercise you were talking about where, for the very large group, where you ask them to close their eyes and imagine having to do something very fast and then having all the time they needed, and then you ask them to do a walking etude. I missed the, what was the aim of the walking etude? What do you ask them and what do you
ask? The first one about the thoughts, the two thoughts, you know, those were simply looking at how we respond to thinking. That thinking is an alive thing that creates a reaction or a response.
Yep.
The second one was to take an ordinary activity and to ask yourself these two categories. Where do I feel light and buoyant in my body? And where do I feel some pressure and heaviness? And everyone could name something. And then the other one was, where do I feel a certain ease of movement, and where do I feel that movement is interfered with? And that would lead me into a whole piece around kinesthetic awareness, because everybody has kinesthetic awareness, but they don't really know it. But everybody could respond to those two things, so it revealed right away that they sense themselves in their body and that they can speak about it.
Okay, so your aim in that walking etude is just to get people to understand kinesthetic awareness.
Yes, that they have that ability.
Okay.
And that's a great beginning for them in terms of this work. Yeah, that's what that was.
Thank you.
Yes.
Hello.
Amanda? Oh, wait, I just want to know, where is Amanda from?
Amanda's from Melbourne, but I live in Dunedin in New Zealand.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
Amanda, you're sounding a little bit like a New Zealander.
No, don't say that.
There's a bit of an edge. All right, so were there anybody else that would like to ask a question?
Hello?
It's just sort of clicked. Yes, hello, who's that?
It's Allison. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Allison,
yes.
Please, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I wasn't sure if you could hear. I'm cooking dinner and doing stuff, but it's Allison from New York City. And
New York City.
Hi, Mead, and I have...
Hi.
And I'm really appreciating all you say, and I learned a lot when I did a workshop with you years ago. But
thank you.
Have you ever worked with children before?
I have done just a little bit with children, and I'd love to do more.
Yeah.
Have you done a lot with children?
No, I haven't, but I'm thinking of helping out in my son's school with a music teacher, and she wants to get the children moving. And so some of these exercises or, you know, activities, I would love to somehow bring Alexander technique to the movement. And I think some of these would work really well with a large group of children.
And children are so willing to play.
Right, yeah.
They really are. And they teach us.
Yeah.
And they usually, I went to a children's dance class to introduce some Alexander possibilities, and I remember that they really understood something about the balance of their heads in relation to their bodies. I brought balloons. I brought balloons for them to play with, and they really enjoyed it, and then they began to move in such a way that their heads were leading and their bodies were following, and they were doing all these little movements because of the balloons. The balloons had made them very buoyant.
Uh-huh.
I didn't tell them that their heads were like balloons.
Right.
But the quality of those balloons became part of them. And they became very free in their movement, and they began to really play with each other and play with the balloons together. So that was something I did that seemed to work for them.
Yeah.
And was fun. Yeah.
Oh, great.
But I think we can invent these things. It's very fun to invent new things and see how it works.
Right.
And see what it might teach them about this work and help them along with it. Yeah.
Well, Mead, I think that's what we'll have to do, is we'll have to make a list of some of these activities, if you like.
Yes.
And start building a list, because wouldn't it be wonderful if there was a resource which
has
been contributed to on a regular basis by people that are experienced, like yourself, of activities that we could just look up and go, I'm looking for something to do with tradesmen, or I'm looking for something to do with brand new people. And we can go on there, have a look, and go, oh, here's a great activity. And someone's been doing this for 10 years, and this is the sort of responses they get. Great. And you've got almost like a class that you can follow.
Right. That sounds like a lot of fun to share these activities. I just wanted to say one more thing too. A couple more things. Do I have time to say one more thing?
Absolutely.
Okay. I wanted to say that I have an article that I wrote for the Congress Papers from Oxford, in which I describe fairly clearly, I hope, three etudes that I did for my class there. So if anybody wants to go look at that article, that would be a place. And I would really like it if we could start sharing these, these studies and explorations that we do with each other, so that we could do what you're talking about. Yeah.
Good, mate.
And
I
just wanted to thank you, Paul, and I wanted to thank the people in my world who have been mentors to me, to bring me along to where I am now. And those people, one of them is Marjorie Barstow, who was a fabulous teacher in a group setting. And my trainers, Bruce and Martha, and then Michael Fredericks, who's brought me on to many workshops, and Frank Ottawell, and Elizabeth Walker, and John Nichols. And it's just wonderful to have mentors. And I have been mentors for other people, and that's what I think we can do for each other, too, is be mentors for each other. And through this forum of group teaching, we can do that. We can be mentors for each other. And then we're a real community, I think. So thanks.
I agree, mate. Yes, please, go ahead.
Oh, yes, I was very intrigued by what you said about the juggling, I'm still not quite sure. Could you explain a little more about, did you talk about the primary control actually, or was it just this experience that they had?
No, I don't talk about anything prior to this experience. Because I don't want to influence their thinking in any way. I want it all to happen spontaneously and naturally.
I see.
Does that make sense? And then we'll start to identify it from there, because if they have the experience as it happens spontaneously, they will then be able to put it together with the actuality of what it is when I start talking about it.
I see.
Does that make sense?
Yes, very much.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if I don't know if there's time or not, but I would love to know a little more about how you work with one person in front of the group.
Okay, it's always different. If it were to be the very first time, one of the things that happens often is when I'm teaching a class and they're sitting in a circle, they're taking notes. They like to take notes, so they're sitting there hunched over, taking their notes, and I start taking them through this whole piece about kinesthetic awareness that I learned years ago from Barbara Connable, and that there's three parts to kinesthetic awareness. The first is relationships of parts to the whole. The second is size, small or large, and the third is a sense of movement or its absence. So I just go over to somebody who's scribbling in their journal with their head pressed forward and their spine, you know, pressed down, and I just ask them to pause and ask them what they notice. And they actually pick up a little something that they notice, that perhaps they're working a little harder than they need to write their notes. And then I do ask them specifically, is there anything you notice about the relationship of your head to your whole body? And they say, usually often will say, my head seems to be forward of my body in some way. So then I ask them if I could use my hand and simply give them a little guidance around this idea of relationship of your whole head to your whole body. So I guide them, you know, and their neck starts to free and their head moves and their body follows it. And then suddenly they've changed that relationship and everybody sees it. So then we have something to talk about as a group. And that's the beginning of the introduction. I take it from something that actually happens before I then, my next phase would be to then select or ask for a volunteer for someone, and I would work with them, introducing them to Alexander's process of inhibition and direction in front of the group. But I often don't do that immediately because they get kind of self-conscious about it. I try to sort of sneak up on it by doing this whole kinesthetic awareness piece while they're writing in their notes. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It gets them red-handed.
Yes, that's it. That's it. And they always enjoy it for some reason. When they recognize it, they go, oh. And I find that really wonderful. Yeah.
Well, that was a great question. Can I ask, who was that asked that question, please? What's your name?
Oh, Deborah.
Oh, Deborah. Oh, thanks, Deborah.
Yeah.
Great.
Where do you live, Deborah?
I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Oh, wonderful. Yes, that's where Michael Gelb is.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, people have already started to dwindle on the call. We're a few people
okay.
to go, obviously. So what we will do, Mead, is we'll wrap ourselves up now. And it's been a terrific exploration of your experience and your ideas and what you do with groups. And I've got a bunch of ideas. And I think what we've done is planted some seeds for some new initiatives at Direction Journal. If we could find a way to build a melting pot, if you like, of workshop and activity group ideas, then
yeah.
I'm going to start working on that to see what we can do. And if you like, we can start
That's
it
great.
Off with some of the material we've talked about today to kick it off.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Paul.
But, yeah, thank you for your time, Mead. Really appreciate that.
Thank you so much. It was great fun.
Yeah.
It was really good.
My pleasure. And you've been listening, ladies and gentlemen, to Mead Andrews, who's based in Florida. All the details are on the website about Mead. I won't go into it again now. But if you go to www.directionjournal.com and have a look at the blog, which I only posted a week ago, it's all about Mead. If you have a free subscription, you'll be able to go and log in, request a login if you don't have one already, and that'll give you access to all sorts of audios, Walter Carrington recordings, live interviews, Congress papers, and other material on the website. So thanks very much, everybody, and it's bye from me.